Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Prospect Podcast. I'm Alan Rusbridger, and today, along with my colleague Sarah, I'm hosting the Intergenerational Conversation, where we ask, who had it harder, the baby boomers or Generation Z? Much ink is spilled on the difficulty young people face in getting on the housing ladder, but just as many newspaper columns are devoted to chastising Generation Z for being shirkers and snowflakes with social media addled minds. So, is intergenerational solidarity at its lowest ebb ever? To explore that question, I'm delighted to be joined today by 90-year-old author and actor Sheila Hancock, who writes the Long Life column for Prospect, and 24-year-old writer and tech worker Alice Garnett, who writes our Young Life column. So we're going to start talking about housing and the economy. Alice, I'm going to address this to you. There's an enormous economic and housing inequality between old and young. It's probably one of the things that young people feel most resentful about. So get it off your chest. Here's Sheila, part of the generation who's
hoarded
all this. How do you feel about that?
I mean, it just makes me cross. As soon as you started talking about houses, I felt my heart rate increase with the rage coursing through me. And I think it's less because I'm not millennial and I'm not yet at the stage where I'd be thinking about buying a house yet anyway or starting a family anyway. It's more the rental crisis that's pissing me off at the moment, because you know I pay $1,200 in rent every month. That's over half of what I earn. I earn a pretty good salary for a recent graduate. So let alone as someone who wants to be a creative, it would just be impossible. I wouldn't be able to pay rent if I were to commit to being a creative. And I think that's something that would have been possible sort of a couple of decades ago. And my mum talks wistfully about rent controls and things like that. And that kind of gets my back up, because I'm like, we don't have rent controls.
So when you feel angry about it, who do you want to blame? Whose fault do you think it is?
I mostly blame the government, but I think pretty much all of the things that make me angry at the moment, I blame on the government, as well as maybe older generations for voting for things like Brexit, which I didn't get a say in. I was 16 at the time, and Brexit's largely behind a lot of the economic fallout that we're experiencing now, and that's something that I had absolutely no say in. But because I do have I think my parents are quite liberal, and my nan was quite sort of sympathetic towards younger people. So none of my anger has ever been towards an individual or like specific older people. It's more the kind of conceptual like boomer, baby boomer generation and the government.
Can I ask you what you make
of Alice's? I'm appalled that they have to pay such high rents, but I don't understand this obsession with wanting to own a house. I mean, that's a sort of propaganda thing, is that you fail if you don't own a house. Never was an ambition of mine to begin with. I mean, eventually I bought a house for £3,000 and did it all up. But I mean, I was about 35.
You just make it worse.
Yeah, exactly. And I sold it for 8 80,000 and it now is worth $1 million, this same house. So it's ludicrous what's happened. But in my day, you know, people from my background, you were jolly pleased if you got on a council estate. That's now frowned on. But in fact, they were beautifully kept. Your rent was, you know, as long as you paid your rent, the hedges were cut and everything was nice and the neighbours were nice. And we've got this obsession that you must own a house, otherwise you've failed. But the other side of that is that it rolls down to mean that rents are exorbitant. But I think you should have the choice of saying, no, I don't want to own a house. I don't want the worry of mending the roof. I'd rather the landlord did it, thank you. And decide to pay your... I mean, in Paris, am I right in saying, Alan, that in Paris, people didn't own buildings at all? Then something changed a few years ago when everybody started buying up apartments in Paris. But up until then, it wasn't a done thing in France. But for some reason, I think it's something to do with Thatcherism, that you failed if you didn't own things.
Alice, you've been very graceful in your response. But when you hear that, and I've got my own story to, you know, I'm younger than Sheila, but nevertheless, I bought a house when I was 30 for £60,000.
Okay. In four, London.
In four-bedroom, four-bedroom house.
Oh.
Which I guess is, I don't know, we sold and moved somewhere else, but that would be worth £700,000 or £800,000 or maybe more now.
Yeah, I was going to say the rent that we pay to our landlord is probably about 45, 50K a year or something like that a year, and that's just for rent.
So do you think that people of our joint generations should be taxed? I mean, that we owe you something back because, in a sense, it's unearned by us. It was we were just lucky to be alive at the time we were.
Yeah, 100%.
I didn't have a cushy time when I was young. I mean, you're making it sound as though one could go around buying houses and everything. I worked damned hard and didn't have much money. I mean, I'm an actor, so obviously, and I was constantly terrified. I had to go and get the dole, you know, and I wouldn't say I had a prosperous, wonderful thing. But the most important thing was that one's education was paid for after a certain age, not when I was young.
But nevertheless, the fact that your house hugely...
3,000, yeah. I got on the step.
So you and I were both beneficiaries of that.
But you know, in the rest of the country, London is ludicrous. But I'm always amazed. I'm involved with a scheme in Liverpool where we buy up with this... building firm, we buy derelict houses. They left an area derelict and then they decided not to knock it down. So we, and then people pay a pound, come in and the builder regenerates it, and that they can afford it. There are ways of getting round this if the government had the intelligence to look at schemes for young people, same as teachers. And one of the biggest problems in London is to get teachers, because they can't afford to live in London. Mm. Now, next door to a local school in Hammersmith was a development, a redevelopment of an old building. And I got onto the council and said, why don't you say that three of those flats must be for the teachers in the school next door? They're at a low rent. But nobody has the imagination to do those sort of schemes. But I do loathe this obsession. I'm worried that you are worried that you can't buy something. I think the most important thing is that you should be able to afford your rent.
I think Gen Z is past the point of worrying about buying somewhere. I think millennials are the generation who can't afford to buy. And what is more concerning is what you're saying, Gen Z is the generation who can't afford to rent. And the fact that I'm paying essentially my landlord's mortgage for him for his second home. And for what? For a rodent-infested place in southeast London where, you know, we regularly get followed home by men on the street. It's not even a safe area to live in, really. And we're still paying through the nose.
What kind of penalty do you think we should pay for having had the good fortune of seeing these houses hugely grow in value under our feet while we did not much to...
I don't really mind so much the people who have one property and it happens to have gone up loads in value. That's kind of fine with me. That's their business. But for people who own multiple properties, particularly if they own vacant properties in London, when we've got people homeless on the street and young people who can't afford to live in the city full stop, there should be huge tax hikes for people like that.
I just think taxes should go up. I mean, yeah. And I don't think it's a penalty. I mean, I wouldn't regard it as a penalty. I would regard it as my duty. I don't do any tax evasion things. I pay my taxes. And I think, you know, a lot of people wouldn't be eligible for tax anyway. And this craze, again, is rather like buying houses. Governments say, we're going to reduce taxes. And the public have got used to judging governments by the fact that they reduce taxes. Somebody should say, no, if you want national health and don't have to want to go to private doctors, or if you want our schools not to be falling down round our ears, you have to pay.
I'm guessing Alice is not going to argue with that.
No, I'm not going to argue with that. I think we should absolutely. I'm all for tax the rich.
Lily,
but it's not even the super rich. Do you know what I mean? A few quid extra from some people would solve so many problems. Our education system is a disgrace at the moment.
Yeah.
The schools are falling down. There are no staff.
I feel like social housing very much was an option and a reality for your generation. My own grandfather lived in a social house for his whole life and it was wonderful for him.
It's called a council house.
Yeah. But now, since Thatcher and the selling off of those social homes, they've moved into the hands of the PRS. I mean, when you look around London, most of the what would have been council flats are now rented out to the likes of me and Alice by private landlords who may at one point down their generations of family bought their home on right to buy. But I feel like it's not only the propaganda about owning home, it's the removal of that option for our generation that means that you are basically, and even the poorest people often, are facing a choice between not a council landlord but a private rented landlord whose whole point and existence is to make profit, not to offer a good
home. Absolutely. I agree with you completely. The selling off of council houses was a crime, as far as I'm concerned. There was nothing wrong in living in a council estate in those days. There really wasn't. In fact, you were bloody lucky if you got a council house.
Yeah.
And as you say, now that they've been poshed up and some people are either living in luxury in them or they're renting them out at exorbitant rents. That's a madness. And that was a government decision to do that.
I live near a sort of final bastion of affordable housing in sort of Zone 2 London because I'm just off the Old Kent Road. And there's the Aylesbury Estate, which is sort of famous in a way. And I know we've had so many pamphlets for about demolishing it. I know that they've evacuated a lot of the building, but it's like, where to? Like, what, you know, you can't just kick a load of people out of their homes and their communities, demolish the house, and then, yeah, build something that's going to be at least £1,200 a month for a room.
How much of this is about intergenerational fairness and how much about class? Because
I think it's a lot to do with class. Everything in this country is to do with class.
Go on. I mean, because the only people who can afford to buy at the moment is the bank of mum and dad.
I just think the divide now, the conditions that some people are living in and what you're saying earlier about the area that you live in, it's shameful. It's shameful. I mean, our council, Hammersmith, I'm lucky. Hammersmith is a very good council and they do check up terrifically on rented property, I believe, and make sure that it's up to standard. And there are rules, but it's got out of control now. It's become a sort of criminal job, isn't it, renting out exorbitant rooms, some sort of little tin pot room, yeah. And people sharing. I mean, when I was young, when I first went, I was a student, I did live in a house where there was one lavatory between about 50 people living in the house. So the conditions weren't ideal then either, but
But Sheila, as a working class person, you know, your whole life you've built your own wealth, you've built your own career, you've been a huge success. And do you feel that now what we're saying, well, I'm actually not Gen Z, I'm just millennial, but basically Gen Z because I'm 1997. Do you feel that what we're saying is Gen Z and millennials, that this is all about generations, this is about old versus young, this is nothing to do with class, that all of us are in the same pot and we're all structurally
yes.
given disadvantage because of our age. Do you think that's fair, or do you think that's...
No, I don't think it's an age thing. I just think it's bad government. I just think there's so many things that have been handled wrongly, and it affects everybody, young and old. I mean, the carer situation, there's a load of things that are disastrous, and people are living dreadful lives, some people. I mean, carers, I'm involved with a carer charity thing, and we've got children looking after their mum, you know, and then going to school and not getting any respite. And I was involved with a charity where we used to have a flat in Shepherd's Bush, believe it or not. It sounds not very glamorous, but at least people could go shopping. And they'd have a week, gave respite to carers for a week just to get away. And we would organise the people that they looked after going temporarily into a home or something. And that was just wonderful, just 1 week for people to have 24 hours to themselves and meet other people in the same situation. But we have no schemes like that. We have no schemes for the sort of quality of our lives. And the quality of a lot of people's lives now are diabolical.
Yeah, and I think what concerns me sort of most is, I don't know, it's quite bleak as a statement, but I don't know, I can't envision how my generation is to grow old in this world, in a world where the NHS is crumbling. We don't really have access to housing in a kind of fair and equal way, because it's only getting worse and worse. You know, the climate is a catastrophe. Everything with technology and social media and AI taking jobs, all of these things, like, the news is just catastrophic. And I often cannot think about the future because I don't know what will be available.
It's a mega revolution. That's what you've got to take on board. And you've got to completely change all your rules. I mean, it's like work. People don't go into work anymore. Hopefully some of those office buildings could be converted into homes. You know, we've got empty office buildings all over London now because people are not going into work. And when are the government going to take that in hand? It's like immigration and all those things. When are they going to be realistic and say, look, climate change means that a lot of people are not going to have countries to live in anymore. Buildings are not going to be used, all these big buildings that we built, because people suddenly, literally, virtually overnight, people are not going into work.
Alice, having a think about class again, we as a generation, obviously, before inheriting any wealth, are struggling more than any other generation for a very long time. But when one in five boomers is a millionaire, at some point, some of our generation will inherit huge amounts of money. They're going to go from being the generation that earned the least amount of money to, you know, when their parents unfortunately pass away, inheriting a lot of money. And so we're going to see unequal kind of futures when you're saying about your generation growing old. Those that haven't got that kind of parental wealth and don't inherit it are going to be left with very little. And those who have are potentially going to become the wealthiest generation purely by the amount they inherit. So is there really any solidarity, any generational solidarity amongst young people when this is a problem that will fall differently on different people's shoulders?
Yeah, I think what you're saying about the sort of bank of mum and dad is very, very real. I guess I particularly saw it at Oxford, like the sort of the disparity. I didn't realise people with so much money existed until I went to university. having come from like a small town in the East Mids, working class young people will absolutely bear a lot more of a burden compared with their middle upper class counterparts. I think the other thing that's interesting to think about on the solidarity point is all of these recent studies that have been showing that Gen Z men are actually more likely to be right-wing than boomer men. Mm. I don't know if you've seen that. Yeah. So actually what we've got for the first time is a generation where there's a gender split in politics, where previously, you know, boomer men and boomer women would generally vote in the same way. We don't have that with Gen Z anymore, and I think that it's becoming more and more and more and more fractious, and there's going to be less and less and less solidarity based on class, gender, all of the different kinds of identities. And I think that's another reason why I'm just really not sure where we're heading.
It's such a shame, isn't it? Because potentially it's another industrial revolution. And if we played our cards right with AI and whatever, all those things, we won't have to work so much at the ghastly jobs. We actually will be able to take care of one another because we want to. Do you know what I mean? That's my ideal, that everybody has a reasonable wage, but the rest of the time they can do what they like. And that's why culture and the arts are so important, because if we don't keep them going, there's nothing to do in the extra spare time that we are inevitably going to have. But I don't hear anybody, I'm sure there are people that I wot not of, discussing these things and having visionary ideas of where the world could go. But I mean, it's like retail. It's over. It's over, isn't it? Shops are closing. I mean, Chiswick is full of closed shops because people are ordering online. So why don't we use some of those shops for clubs, for libraries, for get-togethers? I don't know. Just where's the imagination of, instead of going, oh, it's terrifying, it's awful, why can't we say, no, it actually could be quite exciting? I mean, I think it was Orwell whose ideal was that you wouldn't have to work, that you know, that all those awful, horrible jobs would go, and you actually could be creative and use your intelligence and read and indulge the arts and enjoy the countryside and all that sort of thing. And that's what I want. I want people to have a better way of life.
I'm going to move us on to mental health. And I'm going to start with you, Sheila. I've read quite a lot about your early life, and it wasn't an easy life. You had it quite tough. When you look at the younger generation, do you think they're snowflakes?
No, not at all. I mean, I think COVID has been a disaster for the young people. I mean, I see it with my grandchildren. I really worry about them, that they haven't learnt about friendship. They've had terrible gaps in learning how to live with one another and play games together and do anything but look at their iPads. They're learning in a different way. And they're having to adapt.
I'm going to provoke you a bit. Because Alice, I'm not saying this is true of Alice, but her generation, they have to be warned before they can read a Shakespeare play because it might trigger them.
Yes, if that's being a snowflake, then yes.
And they need safe spaces, and they know what it's like to be.
And I think the whole thing of being careful what you say is quite dangerous, I must say. I do find that tiresome.
So they are snowflakes.
Yes, but they're tough in some ways. They're tough in some ways. But I think when I hear people saying it's never been so bad, it has, you know. It has been as bad.
But you grew up in the war.
Yeah.
That was worse than
yeah,
the war,
but
it?
Even before the war, and when for working class people, it's always been tough. Working in a mill wasn't fun. Working down a coal mine, it wasn't fun, and the money wasn't great. One thing we did have, though, was community. And I think that's my most worrying thing, is that because that kind of work is over, how do we get together? And that's why I care so much about my own profession, because it is a means of people meeting and getting together and doing things together. But I just wish that youngsters would, instead of being so frightened and upset and angry, think, this is great. We can actually change things. We actually can stand up to these stupid bastards that made such a mess. We can vote for the right people. We can learn about politics. What I loathe about the snowflakey lot is they're so ignorant. And I wish that they were more committed. I think there are youngsters who are committed to the environment or Black Lives Matter or Me Too. But I don't see a desire to change the world, which when I was young, we did want to change the world like mad.
Alistair, do you think there's anything in the critique that your generation is a bit snowflakey? Or do you think it's completely unfair?
I would agree that my generation does have some snowflakey tendencies. I am myself not a fan of things like cancel culture because I think it's unproductive, because I also believe that people should be allowed to change. And if we just cancel people, then they don't get the opportunity to do that. And then how are we going to change the world if we don't allow people to change? I think what Sheila's saying about the sort of fatalistic view that my generation has and the sort of nihilism and the sort of doom and gloom attitude is accurate. I think that I do, particularly in my writing, complain a lot without really coming up with solutions. But I think it's just because it feels so impossible. And I think so much of our attention is, and our energy is consumed by work, sort of hustle culture. And obviously we need to work to pay rent, to live, to eat, etc. So there's that side of things.
All the statistics are that mental health problems with young people are soaring.
Yeah.
So, you know, off the scale compared even with 20 or 30
but
years
ago.
But
are they?
Well, look, I'm going to just press Alice first on it. So, and yet there is a way of looking at this, and Sheila, you'll come in on this in a minute, but when you look at the life that Sheila had, that she had real hardship and they didn't have mental health problems. So much.
I mean, obviously there are people with mental illnesses. I'm not negating that, but I do think you think you're ill sometimes, you kids, when you're not. You're just, it's just life. Life's bloody difficult.
Yeah, and I think telling the difference is really, really hard. Mm. You know, and I think it's tricky because I definitely internalized that view when I was a teenager. And, you know, all of my friends around me were getting diagnosed with anxiety disorders and this, that, and the other. And I myself was struggling with some quite difficult stuff, but would just dismiss it because I was taking that view of, oh, I'm not anxious. I don't have a mental illness. This is just life. And I internalized it and I internalized it and I internalized it until I got very sick.
What does that mean, internalized it?
As in I just sort of, rather than critiquing it or speaking about what I was going through, I would just keep it all to myself.
Did you not speak to friends?
No.
Don't you do that nowadays?
I do more so now.
I mean, if I was being unkind to your generation, I mean, we're making huge generalizers, but you're here to represent your generation.
Okay, heavy is the head that wears the crown.
I think in Sheila's generation, there would have been the stiff upper lip. You know, I feel very sorry for it, but come on, you know, get through it. You know, she had to put up with bombs falling on London. A bit of stiff upper lip wouldn't go amiss. Do you think there's something in that?
Personally, no, because I've done that. I've taken that approach to myself quite a lot. Maybe I feel like I'm only one individual out of a vastly sort of diverse generation. But, you know, whenever I've been like, oh, Alice, just grow up, like it's not that bad, it's just blown back in my face. And like when I've tried to not deep things, like being assaulted, it just came back to bite me in the form of depression and like real things like losing a shit ton of weight because I couldn't eat and dissociating and having panic attacks and all of those things. And although sometimes I do think to myself, oh, what happened wasn't that bad, what happened to me wasn't that bad, every woman goes through it. In fact, you know, I'm privileged enough to be living in a sort of post second, third, fourth wave feminism age where, you know, we are approaching equal rights, and there's no way I've been harassed nearly as much as women who are older than me, and I'm grateful for the work that they did to make the world a bit of a safer place for women to live in. And I did try and, you know, take that approach. It's like, oh, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. I'm just, you know, one woman of pretty much every single woman who's ever lived to go through this. So I can get through this. But it just didn't work in my favour.
Stiff upper lip sounds phony and sort of you're having to pretend. But there are occasions when something happens, having talked it through with people, at some point, do you not have to grit your teeth and get on with life?
Can I come in here? Because I am obviously not supposed to be representing Gen Z in this, but I write Prospect's Mindful Life column. And I have a very specific view on the issue of mental health and generation. Because in my family has been mentally ill for generations going back and back and back and back. I think it's complicated, but I don't even accept the premise that younger generations are more mentally ill than previous generations, because there were mentally ill people always. We have always existed, but in the past they were treated terribly and they had just the same kind of symptoms that we have today. Anxiety was anxiety when it was my great-grandmother's anxiety and when it's my anxiety today. It's easy now for older generations to say, you lot are so mentally ill and you don't get through anything and you're always giving yourselves diagnoses. Well, what was the alternative? It was a higher suicide rate and it was the hiding of mentally ill people from view of society. So I don't even accept the premise that we're necessarily more mentally ill. We're just maybe there's less stigma to acknowledging that.
A lot of the people that went into mental institutions weren't mentally ill. They'd had a baby when they shouldn't have done or something like that. But no, I take your point. I mean, obviously, I'm all for drugs. But there was a research done, you know, the Clapham Rail, there was a terrible Clapham Rail thing with hundreds of people died. It was a ghastly, ghastly crash. And apparently some research was done on that, that there was a group of people that were given counselling and continued to have counselling. And then they kept an eye on people that had no help at all, just got on with their lives after this grotesque event. And years later, they have discovered that the people that have survived better than the people that didn't have counselling, that just got on with their lives. And that is not being ill. Do you know what I mean? That is experiencing something awful and dealing with it. I mean, I just constantly have to remind people that life is not easy.
Or fair.
Or fair.
Or just.
But sometimes I meet people who have forced their lives to be all right. Do you know what I mean? They've taken the risks and they've got a nice, steady relationship. And, you know, they have nice children and they have tea and it's all lovely. But they're not living. The horrible things that happen to you, getting over those things is one of the achievements of life, living through it, however you do it. But I am very sniffy about some of the counselling that goes on, all the various sort of schemes and things. I'm all for hypnotism. That's my solution.
I don't know if this is really controversial for me to say, probably is, but I wish I hadn't reported what happened to me to the police. Really? I wish I had just walked away from the encounter and brushed it off, because I think that what caused me to become so unwell was going through the rigmarole of reporting it, talking about it, crying about it, being called up about it all the time by the police. Like, that's actually, I think, what kind of has taken that trauma and really like bedded it into my brain. Whereas had I just walked away.
Well, not just walked away, but positively done something else.
Yeah.
Gone on holiday.
Like, sometimes I think we dwell too much. And I think sometimes there's too much introspection. And it's ironic that I say that as someone who writes a lot of navel gazing articles. But
I tried analysis once. I had to lie on a couch and talk to this man about my terrible childhood and all this, that, and the other. And during the session, well, one of the sessions, I had about five, a phone went and he went out of the room and he answered it. And when he came back, he said, "That annoyed you, Sheila, didn't it, that I answered the phone?" I said, "No, I was just bloody relieved not to have to listen to you." And I left and I never went back again. Do you know what I mean? This sort of everything you did was analysed, and he thought that I was upset. I couldn't care less about him answering the phone. But this idea that he could get inside my brain, and I hated it. I've got a group of friends. Friends are important.
I'd like to tell you about the upgraded digital experience you can enjoy with the new Prospect app. Stay informed and engaged with our independent journalism at your fingertips. Read or listen anywhere at any time. The app not only gives you access to our articles, but also includes audio narration plus podcasts like the one you're listening to right now. Subscribe to Prospect and get instant access to the new app, available on iOS and Android.
Alice, big broad question. Social media.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Balance between
bad.
False.
Yeah, I mean, I say this as someone who was on Instagram from the age of 13, which I guess by today's standards isn't even that sort of young,
because
there are there are people.
Don't start.
I guess I'm an elder Gen Z, being born in 99, and. Yeah, I just remember being online and there was so much grooming. The amount I would talk to... Well, I hope my parents don't listen to this. The amount I would talk to... Like, as a 13, 14-year-old, me and my friends would, you know, chat to random men on Kick.
What's that?
I don't think it's around anymore because it definitely won't have passed any of the child safety. I think, fortunately, today's youth, there's a bit more... policing that goes on with social media, and there's a bit more moderation, whereas when there was none, you know, there was all kinds of horrific stuff on the internet that would have fueled people's eating disorders or like self-harm habits or other kind of harmful behaviors, and now whilst I use it a lot to share my work and to build a personal brand, I still think it's a force for evil, because it kind of obliges you as a creator. You know, you can't just write. You can't just make art. You've got to be a writer. You've got to, like, kind of exhibit this, like I say, personal brand. That you have no choice. You've got to be online. And I also feel like you almost have to be an influencer before you can be a creative.
So I had no voice. I mean, you know, I was working for a local paper, but I had no personal brand. Can you imagine a world before millions of people had any kind of voice at all? So you can feel, I can feel the
or
burden of having
the voice. Communication. I mean, it was an event when we had a phone put in the hall, which my dad wouldn't let us use. But I mean, you know, so we couldn't, if we wanted to communicate with our friends, we had to go round.
I suppose I'm just pushing you to, you obviously feel quite negatively about it at the moment, but would you prefer to go back to a world where you didn't have a voice.
Yeah, I guess I personally have benefited a lot from the existence of social media, particularly with my like newsletter and stuff. I don't know what I'd have been doing, I guess, if I'd been a 24-year-old in the 80s. Maybe writing zines and stuff instead. I don't know. I have no idea what was around then. But I would rather not have a platform and live in a community where people are forced to go around to each other's houses if they want to interact with each other, where I don't have to sort of stress out so much about answering texts. Oh. I hate it. Stop texting. If you're my mate and you're listening to this, don't text me. Yeah. Stop it. I don't like it. Bring back letters.
I think what I've hated about social media is it's opened the door to horrors, underworlds that I didn't know existed. Mm. You know, this male hatred of women thing that my grandchildren tell me about, you know, this man, whatever he's called.
Andrew Tate.
Yeah. And ugly pornography being shown to my 7-year-old. Do you know what I mean? That kind of dirty underworld I felt soiled by, although I don't look at it very much, but just I know my grandchildren are looking at it and I don't want their little minds to be polluted.
When you were growing up, Sheila, it was a much more top-down world, wasn't it? I mean, none of us would have had a voice. It was...
But yeah. I wasn't conscious of that. I was in my world and I didn't know there was another world.
No, but in terms of the way society was structured, and the argument goes, this may not be right, that social media has allowed everyone an equal voice and that our lords and masters now have to pay some attention to us because...
But do they?
No, they don't.
Do they pay any attention to us?
No. We can march every weekend, miles of people saying one thing, and then they say, oh, the country is telling us that, and the country isn't telling them that. I just think I was happier as a child in my little world of the neighbours and my mum and dad and my friends, not, you know, I'm discounting the war now. And I didn't know. I was a clever kid and they wanted me to try for what was called a state scholarship at my school. I got a scholarship to grammar school. I didn't know what university was. I didn't know anybody in the world that had been to university apart from my teachers. And I kind of was all right. I didn't mind about that. I didn't want to know about that world particularly. I regret it now. Of course, I wish I had gone. But I mean, do you know what I mean? We were happy in our worlds. And I'm hating seeing the ugliness. And by God, it's so ugly, the world. I mean, some of the things that come out, the cruelty and the diabolical way that people live and everything. And I wouldn't have known about that. And in a way, I'd rather I didn't. Now I feel I have to do something about it, so I do try, but you know what I mean?
I think the fact that you feel compelled to action when you see all of these sort of horrors, I think that's maybe the primary issue with my generation, is because we were exposed to it from an early age. Yeah. We're just desensitized, and I'm guilty of looking at the news with apathy, even though what is happening is absolutely horrendous. Yeah. Because the alternative is just to feel so angry all of the time. And that's...
Or grief-stricken. I mean, I was driving along with my daughter the other day and there was lots of homeless people and I was crying and she said, "Well, what do you mean?" I said, "This is awful." But it's better that we know, but it's only better that we know if we do something about
it. Yeah, it's the fact that no one's doing anything.
What about the social media that is activism and that is, I mean, I'm just going on a personal example here, but I commission a series for Prospect at the moment called Foreign Correspondence, which is about different areas of the world that don't normally get the spotlight shone on. And how do I find those stories and how do I find those writers? I go on Twitter and these incredible communities of writers, Congo is bleeding is one of the hashtags, you know, hashtags about Sudan, in which writers and people, activists in the country and all over the world are able to contribute together to raise awareness and raise attention. Do you think that could happen before social media in that way?
No, but I don't want to know. I just feel bowled over by the tragedies that are going on. But yes, you're right. And, I couldn't do without Wikipedia. I mean, I look up everything. It's wonderful. Particularly when you get to my age, that somebody talks about an actor and I think, are they dead? And I have to look it up on Wikipedia.
Let's move on to workplace. Now, I'm not a member of Gen Z, so before Alan looks at me and says, yeah, you check out as one of these employees, I'm a millennial. But Sheila, a fellow member of your profession, Jodie Foster, recently made quite a lot of controversy by saying that Gen Z or Gen Z were annoying to work with, mainly because they haven't got very good work ethic. She said, they're like, nah, I'm not feeling it today, I'm going to come in at 10:30 a.m. Do you think young people have less of a work ethic today than you had at their age?
Yes, I do. I think everybody hasn't. I mean, you order a taxi and they arrive half an hour late and say, I'm sorry, the traffic was bad. Of course the bloody traffic was bad. You're living in London. You allow an extra half hour. Do you know what I mean? And I think people are late in a way that I wouldn't have dared to be. I arrive half an hour early. I've been sitting outside here for half an hour rather than be late.
I was arriving late because I was scared to leave my workplace because I didn't want to seem like a work shy Gen Z, because that's how we're stereotyped.
Well, instead of which, you'd arrive late here.
I did. It's hard having two jobs, you know. What's a girl to do?
So do you accept it in general?
I think it's that we're switched on all the time. Like back in the day, I mean, I don't know, I wasn't around, but I assume you'd go to the office, tippy type, go for martinis at lunchtime, I don't know, and then go home and, you know, have dinner, whatever. And your work was in the office and that was it. Whereas now, you know, I could have Slack notifications waiting for me on my phone right now. So I'll be on my way home and I'll be looking at emails, I'll be looking at Slack notifications. Like, you don't really switch off from it in the way that you would have been able to back in the day.
I thought employers were getting used to the snowflakes and saying, poor darlings don't want their Slack notifications, so we're going to switch them off at 6 o'clock now.
That's not in my experience happened.
No, I don't think that's true, actually. One of my in-law girls is, she's on the bloody thing the whole time. She's got her iPad. She's in PR. And she's constantly working all the hours that God sent. I take it back. No, I don't think you are. I just punctuality drives me mad. There's an awful lack of all my daughters are like that. They're always late, always late. And my grandchildren, they're not now because I get so angry. They're frightened of me. But for otherwise, they don't think it's important. And I'm a Quaker, and there was one woman who I'm deeply fond of who always arrives late for meeting for worship. And I actually said to her one day, darling, why are you always late? And she said, I don't know, but I just always am. It was the way she lived. It didn't seem important to be there on time, whereas I'm obsessive about being there on time. I think there are people who are on time and people who aren't.
Do you think also technology has changed our relationship with time? Because maybe when you were younger, you couldn't have said, I'm running 10 minutes late on a text to someone. So if you weren't there, you weren't there.
And you got a bollocking. I mean, you couldn't be late. But I'm also in a profession where you can't be late because, you know, the audiences are not going to be pleased if they say, well, Miss Hancock will be here in 10 minutes. Sorry.
We're going to move on to activism and climate change. So, Anders, I've asked you this question one way, but I'm going to ask you again in a different way. So when you look at the fucked up state of the world, do you blame us or her?
Sheila specifically. Yeah.
do you think, God, that generation really mess things up? And if so, what ways? What about the political and cultural
Brexit
systems apart from Brexit?
Well, that's the main
thing. I think the kind of boomer. God, I said that in such like a venomous way, didn't I? It's all coming out. Yeah, the sort of boomer devotion to work and to capitalism and to buying houses and the nuclear family and the American dream and all of these things is what's landed us, you know, in late stage capitalism, which is ultimately that's why the planet is fucked. And a lot of the reason why I think my generation is work shy is because what the fuck are we working towards if there's not going to be a planet? And it's an anti-capitalism thing, right? Like, I'm paying my landlord's mortgage already. Like, I'm not giving all of my time to a corporation, although that said, the company I'm currently working for is fighting climate change. So, you know, I will give all my time to them. But otherwise, like, no. And I do think it's capitalism and people's devotion to it. It's like the kind of religion of the mid-20th century. I don't know. Like, that's why we're where we are.
There's an advert for kitchens where you have to be ashamed of your kitchen.
What?
Do you know, there's a terrible advert where they say they're trying to sell you getting new cupboards and things. And those sort of values, I think, were... I think I'm younger than the generation that's done all the harm. I think our generation, after the war, did pretty well with the national health and, you know, and free education and all sorts of things that came in. I think it's the generation afterwards, the 60s, when we went crazy and all the values changed. I just want our values to be good. I think we've had politicians who lie. Lying has become acceptable now, hasn't it? You know, and Brexit is the biggest crime as far as I'm concerned. And that is mainly the older generation. I mean, it's been proven that they voted in. Your comfort, darling, is that we're dying out. So, you know, there will be another vote. But we have done huge damage to Europe by coming out. We were an important part of the European Union. And I think they miss us dreadfully.
And what about the damage to the planet, that your generation?
Oh, dreadful.
And do you accept responsibility?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I do, because I didn't know. It was kind of ignorance, really, wasn't it? I didn't know about it. I mean, now I do. I try to not fly, and I try to do... I've got panels, and I've had panels from the very beginning, but, you know, I mean, we've got to do something about it, but it's so easy to think, oh, well, that little bit, that one little flight to Paris won't make any difference. It's terribly difficult to get... Unless we have somebody, I mean, already Starmer has come out of the agreements, the Green Agreement. That's shameful. How can he do that? Why does he not realise that there's a younger generation that would have voted Labour for that?
I do wonder if Labour give a shit about young votes. Like,
it's weird.
It's very strange. But basically all of his policies he's just gone back on, hasn't he? Like, I don't actually know what a vote for Labour means, other than it's not a vote the Conservative Party. And I think that's the other thing. There's this sort of sense of powerlessness that, you know, actually there is no right person to vote for.
No.
So as a generation, we just feel like, okay, our money's being sucked dry by high rents and the world's on fire and the government's corrupt and even Labour's not really doing much and they're meant to be kind of, I guess, on our side in a way. So that we do feel a bit victimised.
I just want to unpack what the things that I'm hearing you saying, which is like, okay, all this bad stuff has happened. I don't agree with all this late capitalism. I'm not going to bust a gut to do that, and I'm going to pay all this rent. And all this stuff is on my social media screens, and I'm desensitised to it.
Mm-hmm.
That could come across as sort of fatalism.
Yeah. You
know, I've been dealt a shitty hand of cards. What do you want me to do about it? As opposed to, okay, I've been dealt a shitty hand of cards and my generation's going to roll up their sleeves.
But how
and
they?
Well, I'm just interested in the balance between, oh my God, and,
let's
okay, we've got to sort it out.
I think that's it. I think that I think actually that's something that my generation could learn from older generations. I think that because there's so many issues and so pressing in on us from so many angles and through our screens all the time, there is a sort of constant state of overwhelm, which sort of, yeah, does result in fatalism and nihilism and sort of giving up in a way. And I think that actually what we could learn from older generations, if we were able to come together a little bit more, is how to take action.
But do you not despair about how you do it? Because, I mean, at the moment, there's so many things happening, like the war and Gaza and Ukraine and all that. And people are feeling things about it, but the government isn't expressing what I think the public are feeling. And I think it's very difficult for youngsters to know where to go. If only some... You see, after the war, we had Attlee, we had Anaren Bevan, we had all sorts of people with vision, determination and a knowledge of background. And also people had been in a war together. All the classes had been mixing together and had a dreadful time and came out determined to try and change. And it was a long time while it was grey and horrible before things began to get better. But I don't see now, if I were you, I would be thinking, well, I want to do something, but what can I do? Would you not, Alan? I mean...
I think so,
well,
yeah.
you run a magazine, so that's what you do. But do you know what I mean?
We all do our bit, don't we?
Yeah. We do our bit, right. But then the magazine doesn't get read by the people that we want to read it.
No, it does. Well, they all get a copy over at House of Commons. I'm going to put you each on the spot. Who had it harder?
What, the younger or the older?
Yeah. Who had or has it harder?
I can't answer that. I don't think either has it harder than the other. I really don't. I mean, the good thing about being old is that you'll be dying soon, so you haven't got to put it right. You know what I mean? I don't have to think, oh, God, I've got to really change this, because I've only got a few years left and she's got lots of years.
Yeah, I think it's hard because, like I was saying earlier, I've only had 24 years on this planet. I haven't lived through a world war. The only kind of catastrophic thing that's happened really is COVID, which, you know, my life was never at risk from that. However, I don't know how we as a generation will grow old in this world. I think that that old age might not be a privilege afforded to us. And for that reason, I would say that we have it harder, like right now, but more kind of in the future. And that is very fatalistic of me, and I'm sorry.
But I think old people already haven't got a very good time. I mean, I'm all right because I've got a bit of money, but there are old people that are not cared for and dying badly. So it's already started, and I agree with you.
You've got another 65 years to go to.
Oh, it's a shame. I want you to love life. I mean, you know, spring is coming. The daffodils are in St. James's Park, and it is a wonderful world. I mean, that's what's so tragic. It is a potentially the most beautiful place. Do you not ever feel that, you know, when you go to somewhere lovely and you think, oh, gosh, this is so lovely, when the sun is out? And do you not feel that ever?
In Italy, maybe. Perhaps not in the UK.
That's all right. In Italy, anywhere. I was driving in today and I was thinking how lovely London is.
It was a beautiful run that I did, sort of half jog down Regent Street from Holborn to get here 15 minutes late.
That's very chic as well.
I felt like I was in Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah, on your way to your magazine.
That's what you've got to do. You've got to look for the good thing. The important things in life are always the little things, funnily enough. And your friends.
Well, thank you both for a fascinating conversation. Meeting of minds, meeting of generations. It's been great.
That's all for now. If you enjoyed this podcast, then head to our website at prospectmagazine.co.uk. This episode couldn't be made without assistant editor Sarah Collins and producer Martin Poyts-Roberts. Goodbye for now, and hope you join us next time.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.